We're doing Jewish history. We had begun discussing the men of the Great Assembly. We discussed their institutions. We discussed Ezra the scribe. We discussed the ascent to rebuild the second Beit HaMikdash. And now we shift to the prophets of this period. They are the final prophets. Our tradition is that prophecy ended with the beginning of the second Beit HaMikdash era. We have the final three prophets, Zechariah, Haggai, and Malachi. So we have Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Zechariah is probably the most difficult prophecy that we have of all the prophets. Rashi himself writes in Zechariah what he doesn't write in any other prophet. He writes, I'm not really sure what's going on here. I'm going to do my best. Rashi says, I'm going to try. We don't find that Rashi on any other book of Tanakh. That Rashi tells us this is difficult prophecies. And Zechariah speaks about amazing visions. As we saw, one of the visions about how they would take down the desire for paganism, for idol worship. So Zechariah prophesizes during the second year of the Navi Daryavesh. There's an overlap. He, Haggai, and Malachi are at the same time period. They're all three members of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the men of the Great Assembly. They are part of the team that compiles the eternal prayer that we say till today, the Shmona Esrei, those 18 blessings that we say three times a day. They were a compilation of the men of the Great Assembly with Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. They were the three prophets on the board, on the men of the Great Assembly. Now, we don't know exactly who Malachi was. There's a Medrash that says Malachi was a code name for Ezra, that Ezra himself was a prophet, Malachi. There's an opinion that says Mordechai was Malachi. So the Talmud and the Midrashim give us different opinions as to who really was this figure, Malachi, who gives us the final prophecies. We know the final words of the prophet Malachi are about the coming of Elijah the prophet. We know Malachi begins his prophecy discussing the difference between Yaakov and Esav, the twins that took completely different paths in life. So we have Malachi, and it seems Malachi is the final prophet, that he outlived Haggai and Zechariah. We move forward to the year 3412. We are 6 years into the reign of Darius, Daryavesh, and it's at this year that the Pasuk says in the book of Ezra, Vesheitzi Vaita Dena. Sheitzi was finished, Vaita Dena, this bayit, this house. So in the book of Ezra, we have a record that in the sixth year of Daryavesh, Darius, which was the year 3412, in that year they completed the building of the second Beit HaMikdash. Now, they were under the rule of the Persian Empire, so they had to draw a figure of Shushan by the gate, by the entrance to the Heichal. So ordinarily, we wouldn't stick in any figure that we didn't that wasn't ordained by heaven. We had a tradition how to draw and how to make every part of the Beit HaMikdash. But here, the Persians said, we're licensing this, we're funding this, and we insist there be a mention of the capital, Shushan. So there's a gate called Shar Shushan, the gate of Shushan, and it had inscribed over it a figure, a shape of the city of Shushan, just like we have Jerusalem of gold. So they had a figure of Shushan. We move forward 1 year. We've finished building the Beit HaMikdash. It's the year 2413, and Baruch ben Neriah passes away. Baruch ben Neriah is a link in the chain of tradition. If Jeremiah, the prophet, was the father of the prophet Yechezkel, right? We discussed Yechezkel ben Buzi. That's a nickname for Jeremiah. Jeremiah was mocked. The word buz means to mock. So because the Navi Jeremiah was mocked, they called his son Yechezkel ben Buzi. But Jeremiah had a student, his prize student was Baruch ben Neriah. He's the one that actually writes down the Megillah of Eicha. When it comes to the scroll of Lamentations, the one who actually wrote it down was Yirmiah's prize student, Baruch ben Neriah. When the Jews are exiled, Baruch ben Neriah goes into exile, and he is the teacher of Ezra Sofer. Ezra the scribe does not ascend to Israel. So long as he could learn by Baruch ben Neriah, he does not leave the exile, he does not go up to Israel. Now the year 3413, a year after the Beit HaMikdash is completed, Baruch ben Neriah passes away, and right away Ezra packs his bags and starts heading for Israel. The whole reason he hasn't come until now is because his Rebbe was alive. So the second his Rebbe passes away, Ezra heads up to Israel. And here we have the ascent of Ezra. When Ezra is going up to Israel, he's not coming up alone. So Ezra starts telling the Jews in Babylon, you got to come with me, it's time to go. We've hit the seventh year of Dariavesh, which according to some texts in some places is called Artaxasta. We said the Persian kings had numerous names. And Ezra is headed up to Israel. Just like all the Egyptian kings of a certain era are called Pharaoh, so in this era, all the Persian kings are called Artaxasta. Just like all the kings of Philistines are called Avimelech. So we have a name that's like the term like presidents or excellency, your highness. So there's Artaxasta, which was a term of royalty under the Persian Empire.
Do we have one for Jews?
Melech?
Is it just Melech? No, it's not like it's a...
I think so. Okay. Ezra comes into Israel. And the people come to him on Rosh Hashanah. The leaders tell him, we have a problem. You see all these wonderful families? They've intermarried. You have many people here who are married to non-Jewish women. Ezra has with him, he has Nehemiah, and they have a license from the king to punish, to beat up, to take away people's assets. They have they've been given rulership of the Jews in Israel, and Ezra begins by telling the Jews, you can't stay with non-Jewish wives. And what Ezra's really doing is incurring the wrath of all his neighbors, because what's going to happen now? These families that are broken up, the women are coming back home to their family and saying, I was a great wife and my husband divorced me just because I'm not Jewish. So you had a situation where Ezra's neighbors weren't too pleased with him, because people were getting the daughters coming back home saying, I did nothing wrong, but he's upset at me just because I'm not Jewish. And Ezra stands his ground. All these men separate from their non-Jewish wives. And then he goes on with Nehemiah to rebuild the fortification of Jerusalem. The people of Jerusalem were being lazy, and they wouldn't listen that the walls were weak. So what Nehemiah did was one night he got up with his servants. Now Nehemiah was the king's personal assistant. So when the king gave him license to go to Israel, the king told him two things. You're the powerhouse there, and you better come back. I'm waiting. So Nehemiah has a close relationship with the king. And even so, he can't get the Jews to get their act together and rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. What he does is he gets up in the middle of the night. He takes his servants with him. And they go to one of the walls, and they just knock it down. Now, what's his point? The next morning, the Jews wake up and they say, hey, what happened to our wall? So his point was they should see that in an hour, you could actually knock down that wall. They felt secure because they had a wall. But in reality, their wall was worthless. So the way Nehemiah gets them to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem is by actually knocking down the walls. He starts knocking them down, and so the Jews wake up and realize someone just knocked down a large segment of our wall. We weren't even aware of it. And so people started rebuilding it. In the book of Nehemiah, We have a record of who built which part of the walls, and ordinarily people built the wall that was right next to them. Like where they lived, they would rebuild the wall. In Israel, that used to be the case also. People used to pay for the paving of the street next to their house. This was common practice because people believed in it. People wanted to help build the state. At the time of the founding of the state, people would invest their own private assets to make things succeed. So over here, you had a lot of people who were donating of their time and their assets to rebuild the walls and fortify Yerushalayim. We discussed Ezra's 10 institutions. And the Jerusalem Talmud says, we discussed this last week, that when Ezra ascended from Babylon, he not only brought with him the names of the months, but he also brought with him the names of the angels, right? Remember, we don't find names for angels until we reach the final books of prophets, in the book of Zechariah, and the book of Daniel. Only there do we suddenly read about the names of the different angels. So the Jerusalem Talmud says, yeah, that came up with them from Babylon. The Gemara tells us, in the end of Masechet Tractate Kiddushin, that not that many Jews came up with Ezra from Babylon. That when Ezra tried to encourage the Jews to go, no one wanted to listen. So Ezra could only bring with him the Jews who he could threaten. So the rabbis in those days, and to some degree also today, they know the genealogy of people in a way that no one else knows. I can tell you that I have secret files. Students that have asked me to work with them on verifying their genealogy. Are they Jewish or not Jewish, etc.? And do they have to undergo giyur or not? And I have at home, I have in a hidden place, my wife's never seen it, files of many people who wanted to, who we worked together to verify whether they were or weren't Jewish. So what ends up happening is you work with people, you end up knowing. This comes up in many realms. So Ezra used that knowledge to his advantage because Ezra knew which people were disqualified. He knew which person was a mamzer, right? He knew which person was disqualified and couldn't marry into any other Jewish family because he was really a sold servant who had escaped. And all the years Ezra didn't tell anyone, but Ezra knew the secrets of everyone's, of many people's genealogy. So Ezra would go over to families and say, look, I could just divulge this information because I'm leaving. And when I leave, so the rabbis have to know. Until now, I knew your information. If you come with me, I'm keeping quiet. If I have to leave you here, then I'm leaving the information to the local board. So the people panicked. They said, no one will marry into our families. We're going to end up being ostracized. So Ezra had the majority of the people who came with him were people who had problems in their ancestry. Problems, I mean, that they were not legitimately kosher Jews. This one was a descendant, he was a bastard, he was a mamzer. That one was a slave who never really was freed. His master died and they hadn't really worked out the paperwork. He had the tradition of every family, or many families. And so the Talmud says that what Ezra did to Babylon was to work like a sift. When you sift out flour, so you end up with fine flour, it says that's what Ezra did to Babylon. That in Babel, in Babylon, you could assume any Jew that was there after Ezra came from a perfect family. There was no problem with their genealogy. Because anyone that Ezra could blackmail a little bit, Ezra did. And that's how Ezra got these people to come up to Israel. Because otherwise they wouldn't have come. Ezra couldn't get the Jews to budge. So it seems a little bit harsh, but if you think about it the other way, what happened to the Jews that remained there? Many of these families ultimately got lost. The people were lost. So in Israel, they had a rebuilding. They rebuilt the Beit HaMikdash. They settled the land. So Ezra brings with him thousands of Jews, not as much as he would like or we would like. And then there are many Jews who don't come. The Jews in Egypt don't come. There's a Yemenite tradition that they don't name their children Ezra. And they say, the Yemenites, that when Ezra sent them letters and said, come join me, we're going to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, the Yemenites said, things are good here, we're not leaving. At which point, according to the Yemenite tradition, Ezra cursed them, and his curse came true. And so they, the Yemenites, according, again, this is, I don't know if this is recorded anywhere, but this is the Yemenite tradition that they don't name any of their children Ezra because of that. Ask a Yemenite. And tell me what they say. I heard it many years ago. I'm not sure I'm remembering correctly. So you find out and you tell me. Oh, yeah.
Can a curse, like, carry on?
Yeah. You want, we could learn about another curse that Ezra made. But that, remind me, Thursday night, we'll bring the paperwork, we'll learn the Medrash inside.
He loves Thursday night.
You just have to tell me, you know, send me a reminder Thursday morning so I could print out the text. We'll learn the Medrash. There's a fascinating Medrash about a curse Ezra placed. No, it's very important. It's a very important Medrash. Gilad, so you have an important mission here. Thursday morning.
I'm pulling up the file right now.
Good.
So let's say you have absolutely no memory whatsoever of this whole.
Just say, please print out the Medrash of Ezra's cursing the Kutim. Kutim. Come Thursday night, we'll learn who the Kutim were.
In suspense.
You could write Ezra cursing them with 400 shofros. We'll learn about that Bezran Shem Thursday night.
Okay, wait, I'm writing this down. To remind you, you want me to say the curse of Kutim?
Kutim, yeah. Kutim. With 400 trumpets, 400 shofros. Kutim. So, the Jews had a tradition that the Second Temple wouldn't last either, as we discussed earlier. And that's why, according to many sources, the Jews from Spain refused to leave to rebuild the Second Beit HaMikdash. The Jews from Egypt refused to leave. The Jews from Ammon, Moab, Greece. There were Jews in Greece from the days of the destruction of the first temple. We had a student here who came from Greece, and he told me that their tradition in Greece is that they're there since the first temple's exile. So that's what he told us. There are sources that back that the Jews were exiled as far as Greece with the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, and they didn't want to come back. They refused to come back to rebuild the second Beit HaMikdash. And we are up to the great leader of Israel named Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel. And we will learn about him, Be'ezrat Hashem, tomorrow night.